This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. When you drive through the Arroyo Seco up the 110 to Pasadena, take a look off to the east, just behind the Avenue 60 bridge. Rooftops, dozens of little ones, surrounded by a fence and behind a security gate. Standing in the middle of them, you can see each is about the size of a garden shed, 8 by 6 feet. Their outside walls are painted with hearts, rainbows, bumblebees, and bunnies.
Welcome to the largest tiny home village for the homeless in the country. This is the Arroyo Seco Tiny Homes. It's 117 units and 224 beds.
That's Rowan Van Sleeve, president of Hope of the Valley Rescue Mission, which operates this tiny home village. It's an alternative to a homeless shelter with a separate shed for each person or couple. It's meant for unhoused adults who live within a 3-mile radius.
And that's important. If you're going to have a homeless shelter in your community, you should see people in that area get off the streets first. You want to see your streets cleaned up. You don't want people being bussed in from all over the city.
But when these homes open next week, will the unhoused neighbors actually want to live here? Reporter Kirsten Zilm went to find out.
About 3 blocks from the new tiny home village, I met Gina.
You want to look in here?
It's not a tent. It's
Gina has been living on the streets for 6 years. She's embarrassed about her living situation and does not want to give her last name. The 51-year-old constructed her own precarious little home out of shelves, tarps, and blankets on a dirt spot at an intersection in Highland Park. She signed up for a tiny home as soon as she heard about it.
Just tell me when it's open and I'll be there. I just washed all my blankets last night, so I'd probably take my blanket, my comforter, and my clothes, my backpack, my shoes.
Gina also heard about the rules in the village. Weapons, drugs, and alcohol are not allowed inside the fence. Curfew is from 10 p.m. to 6 in the morning. There is no running water in the homes and bathrooms are shared. The furniture consists of 2 beds that can be pulled up and latched to the wall, a small desk, a bookcase, a kennel for those who bring a pet, and one more thing Rowan Van Sleeve says is crucial, a key.
The locking door is probably the most important part of this shelter. To a woman who's been a victim of violence on the street, that locking door can be the difference between her getting health and healing and staying on the street.
Gina agrees. Having a place she can lock is worth playing by the rules. She cannot wait to have an address again.
Because then you could get a banking account, and you have to have an address for insurance if you have a car. You wouldn't be wearing dirty clothes and shower before work and get a good night's sleep.
She tries to convince 2 friends to also give the tiny homes a chance.
Well, it's got air conditioning. They take you to and from if you need.
In the plus column, air conditioner, heating, 3 meals delivered every day, mental health counseling, and help with the search for permanent housing. Matt can't get over the curfew from 10 to 6.
That I got a problem with, curfews. I mean, my mom stopped telling me when to go to bed when I was like 7 years old, you know, so I mean, I pretty much think I'm capable of deciding when and where I'm going to go to bed, you know.
Matt is 57 and would also not give his last name. He lives in a camper parked near Gina's spot on the sidewalk. Matt has looked at the tiny home village from a distance. All those flowers, hearts, and bumblebees painted on the homes are another turnoff for him.
Oh, it's a little too cheerful for me. I'm not really like, I don't live in a circus or like, you know, it's not that happy every morning.
I don't even want to go try it right now. I live right across the street from the 99 cent store. I got wholesale prices. I'm content.
Matt's friend, Gary Shefford, has been sleeping at the same spot on a Highland Park sidewalk for 12 and a half years. To Gary, moving to the village would mean leaving the comfort of everything he knows.
They put me in a home down here. I couldn't find anything. I didn't know what anything was. Over here, I know where the churches are. I can go get a free meal if I'm hungry. See, I'm 70 years old, you see, and I'm injured, you see. It might sound that easy to you, but it's not so easy to all of us.
Stephen Smith can relate. In February, the 59-year-old moved into a similar tiny home shelter in North Hollywood.
I didn't sleep the first night. I'm not going to lie to you. I did not sleep the first night.
This site has 39 homes, and it took Stephen a while to get used to people moving around him all the time. The first week, he kept his routine, had food and a beer in his car before returning to the village. He did not talk with anybody.
I was listening to see what's going on and what's not going on. 42 people just walking back and forth and everything else, where I was pretty much used to staying in my car and I didn't have to deal with nobody.
Stephen is more comfortable now. He installed a TV in his tiny house and stacked books, soup cans, water, and air freshener neatly on the shelves. Stephen started to appreciate the caseworker, the structure the shelter gives him, the available services, and the camaraderie.
I look at that as people honestly do care. Because when you're out in the street, people really do not care about you. Let's get that straight.
Not everything in this village is perfect, Stephen warns. He would like to have a kitchen and be allowed to bring a knife for chopping vegetables. He has seen people return to the streets because they broke the rules. Others preferred to go back to encampments where they formed a community of friends.
So this here is the bed. There's two in each unit. Right now under COVID.
Not only the unhoused need assurance that a tiny home shelter in their neighborhood is a good idea, says Hope of the Valley president Ron Van Sleef.
Every time we open one of these sites, we get the death threats from the community, the protesters, the not in my backyard community. Nobody's ever going to go, I want a homeless shelter in my neighborhood. It's not going to happen.
That's why Hope of the Valley offers open houses, tours, sleepovers, and events like art walks before the opening of a new village. Karina and Jose Rivas have come to take a closer look. They live 1 minute from the shelter, and when they found out about it, they were initially concerned it might be bad for the community.
At first, I was a little bit skeptical, but visiting now, I see the bigger picture, and so it brings hope.
Rowan explains to them that the site is funded by the city of Los Angeles, costs $23,000 per bed, and that the expected time until residents leave for permanent housing is 6 to 9 months. Karina and Jose now see it as a cost-effective way to help the unhoused in their community and get them off the sidewalks.
We've seen what's been created for the people in need of a shelter. Puts you at ease to know that the only difference that's going to happen is it's going to create more neighbors for us. And hopefully this is a one step for their future to progress.
Meanwhile, around the corner, Matt listens to Gina's pitch and seems to be wavering. He is already on a list to move in when a house is available and says he might be willing to give the cheerful tiny homes and even the village's rules a chance.
Well, some are safe to sleep, you know, but the air conditioning sounds pretty good. The shower, that's probably number one. That's the worst part of being homeless is where do you wash up? I mean, the beach, the street, you know.
New residents can start moving into the Arroyo Seco tiny homes on Tuesday. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Sill.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. Students in Los Angeles are back in school, many back on site, after months stuck on screens with Zoom classes and isolated from their classmates. Now, the toll of that year and a half of remote learning is just now starting to show its colors. The LA Times analyzed data over the past school year to find out how students are faring after school closures and after the remote learning went into effect. They found, quote, deep drops in assessment scores, or below grade level standing in key areas of learning. Black, Latino, and other vulnerable children have been particularly hard hit. Those are their words. Well, to find out what that looks like on the ground, we asked our LAUSD teachers, whom we've been keeping up with during the pandemic, about how things are going. Aviva Alvarez-Zaxson, Ms. Z as she's known. She teaches world history and ethnic studies over at Hamilton High School off of Robertson. Aviva, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, and Christy Collette teaches third graders over at Newcastle Elementary in Reseda down in the valley. Christy, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Great to talk to you both again. Aviva, I'm going to start with you. Before we get into the grades and the reading and the math scores, how do you feel this year has been going so far back in the classroom?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think we're all very glad to be back for so many reasons. And it's been an adjustment. It's been tough. I mean, we haven't been around this many people in so long, and now we have for a few months. But before, you know, you forgot that other people breathe, right? And have other body sounds and motions. And it's just been a real adjustment for everyone, adults and students alike.
The one thing about school, Aviva, is the fact that it's not only learning, it's also social, right? Like when you're a kid, school is your social life. And students missed out on a lot of both of those things, educational and social. Do you have students who are struggling to keep up this year? And if so, how?
Interesting that you ask about socially, because that's also an area that students are struggling to go back to and, I guess, theoretically keep up with. Learning is social. It's social on all parts. And part of what's hard to keep up with is the social aspect. You know, I think that learning was, despite our best efforts, really desocialized in the sense that students were not really working with each other or working around other people. And now they have to balance, not only do I have to keep up with whatever the teacher is instructing us to do, but I have to also keep up with what's going on around me socially. And balancing all of that, I think, has a huge part to do with what's being difficult for students, is that you're not just worrying about, you know, do I get this math problem? I'm also worrying about, what do my peers think about me getting this math problem or not?
Well, I mean, so let's break that down just a little bit. In what ways do you feel like your students have been most affected by the closures in which subjects?
So I think there's a lot of elements there. Just kind of like a note, if students are struggling in math and reading, that means they're struggling across the board. It means that all subjects are hard right now. And I think part of that comes from, well, first off, we have to remember that last school year, students were getting instruction for a lot less time. The school day is much, much longer. So the stamina that's necessary to keep up through the whole school day, tough. And then on top of that, the reality is, like, if you talk to anyone honestly, last year's school was different, and we could not cover everything we wanted to cover as well as we could have. And let's not pretend that students were academically successful on average last year. Most students were still behind. They just necessarily weren't critically failing. And so that's kind of the circle. And there, I think that we sometimes forget, students are aware of that. They know that they had a different year last year. They know that they have missed instruction, or they have missed something. A lot of our students missed many days of school last year, or if they were in class, doesn't necessarily mean that their connection was strong or that they were really totally internalizing the material. And now we're plopping them in campuses for 7 hours a day. It's tough. that's the whole thing.
Christy, 7 hours a day. I mean, same over there in Reseda as well, right? I mean, what kind of issues are you seeing over there? Same kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely the same type of stuff. At our age, I don't necessarily want to say that they're behind, but we did have significantly less hours in the day in which we were able to provide instruction for them online. For me, I think academically, I think the area that they're the furthest behind in is writing, because we never saw them write with their pen and their paper. We only saw written work that was turned in that they had typed.
So you're talking like penmanship. You're talking like, you know, pen and paper as opposed to something on a screen.
Correct. Using uppercase letters, using punctuation, being able to spell correctly without the aid of spell check. As far as socially, I do feel that they're maybe a little bit less mature this year than they usually are. I spend a lot of time in my day telling them to stop touching each other because they're like little magnets. You know, they just want to be right next to each other all the time.
In the LA Times analysis, they found that fewer students in elementary school were meeting the grade level reading goals than the year prior to the pandemic. Are your students, Christy, are they struggling to meet their reading level goals? You mentioned writing. They haven't been, you know, they weren't writing pen to paper, pencil to paper. But what about reading?
I don't see a significant change this year as opposed to other years. Every year it's going to be a little bit different. Some years you'll have higher classes, some years you'll have a lower class. It definitely affected some kids, but overall, I'm not seeing a huge change.
In the past school year, Christy, you were concerned about returning to teach on site over at Newcastle. You had talked about even having a precondition, right? Like being a little unnerved by that because you didn't want to be exposed. Obviously, you were concerned about your own health. Where are you now? Right. How are you doing now?
You know, now I think just being desensitized to it a little bit helps. At my particular location, we have had zero cases for, knock on wood, many, many, many weeks in a row. So, you know, wearing their masks, doing the testing, it's working. The longer we go without getting any new cases, the more comfortable everybody's feeling.
Aviva, obviously high schoolers are often thinking about what's next. College, wow, college, you know, you're on the cusp of being a grown-up. It's a pretty scary time. How are your students doing with meeting the requirements to graduate and then go on to higher education?
Well, some of them are having some pretty scary conversations right now about classes that they need to have passed in order to graduate. There's also the issue when it comes to D is for diploma, C is for college. So the reality is most students are pushed to at least receive their diploma. That doesn't necessarily mean they have a future for college. And that's frustrating to observe from the teacher standpoint. And at the same time, it's kind of showing the grim reality of what's the circumstances some students are in. Again, I kind of echo what Christy said. It's not so much that they're behind. It's that we need to do something there. I mean, the way I kind of see it is like people say like, oh, we can't let all hell broke loose. All hell did break loose on our students. Their lives are so different now. I have more students who are working than ever, students with jobs, and their managers forget that they're high school students and schedule them for really, really tricky hours. I have more students who are in charge of childcare for their families than ever. More students reporting back just levels of exhaustion that I haven't seen before. It's hard to focus on things like college or graduating when we're trying to get through the day or the week.
Wow. What are you doing, Aviva, to help them get the care and the attention that they need? You're a teacher. You're there during certain hours of the day. But obviously, you hear and feel their pain, right?
Yeah. I haven't had this many like students come up to me and say, hey, can I talk to you outside in, you know, a single semester in my a short teaching career, but still. It's a lot of listening. It's a lot of just hearing first before delving out like the natural consequences that happen when we don't get our work done. It's a lot of empathy and compassion, which takes a lot of emotional energy. But it really just kind of comes down to give me your context so we can apply reason to it. So, okay, you had to work really, really late last night, and then you had this issue with getting your sister to school this morning, and you couldn't get your homework done. All right, can you get it to me by Friday? And it's those short-term goals, because I think while during pandemic we were able to say, like, okay, we have until the end of the semester to get this done, now they really need those short-term, like, okay, I'm going to get this to you by this day, and if that doesn't happen, okay, I'm going to get it to you by this next day. And it's a lot of individualized attention. I had a coworker say that really resonated, like, I just feel like a social worker right now more than a teacher. Yeah. And that's kind of what it feels like sometimes. It's hard to talk about, you know, the enlightenment when everything is just
a mess.
Yeah. Christy, you have younger kids in your classroom, so it's, I mean, you probably don't hear I'm talking about work, but they're still having to deal with a lot of things.
Yes. And, you know, my students aren't working, but a lot of their parents are in those types of jobs. A lot of parents who work in the food industry, even with our students, they are being required to help take care of their siblings a lot more than usual. So there is still some of that impact on them.
Do they come to you for help? Do they ask for your advice?
Yes. This year, I do feel like they are very emotionally needy. They need a lot of reassurance, especially when it comes to whether or not they're doing their work correctly. It's almost like they write one sentence, they want your critique on it. They do one math problem, they want you to make sure that it's correct. A lot of emotional crying. We have been testing them to death. In the past 3 weeks, I've had to give 4 major assessments. And those aren't even classroom tests. It's a lot.
That's a lot, Christy. You're at the flashpoint, right? You're sort of having to deal with the emotions of all of this because they're with you for a big part of their days. How are you doing? How's your well-being?
I think with like most teachers, we're hanging in there the best we can. It's definitely more physically exhausting this year. You know, with the masks, there's ventilation. So the fan is constantly blowing. So you can't hear what anybody's saying. So we're not yelling, but we have to speak very loudly all day long and constantly telling the kids, can you repeat that? Can you repeat that? Can you repeat that? So it's very physically draining.
You have the same thing happening at your school, Aviva?
It depends on the classroom. We're a really large campus, so different buildings have different ventilation needs. Some classrooms have like 5 fans going, and it's really noisy and it's distracting. And whenever somebody asks me, how are you doing? I look at them in the face and I say, do you really want to ask me that question? Because get ready, I will unload. Everything is on fire.
Well, I really do want to ask you that question. I mean, how are you doing?
In all disclosure, in my short teaching career, this is the year I've wanted to quit the most. I'm getting a little emotional, sorry. It's really, really hard.
It's a lot.
There's so much need.
You can't do it all.
To try to do it. And I'm not even trying to do it all, truthfully. I'm trying to just be there for the students, but there's so many of them and they have so much need. And
because you have a life too,
and
outside of that school.
Exactly. And to even like knowing that is almost the comfort, is just knowing that I can't, but still wanting to, and still trying to be, you know, nice to the people I live with when I get home.
Whew, it's so much. I want to thank you all for talking to us and coming on regularly to give us updates on how you're doing. I know there's so much stress. Teachers are heroes and you're our heroes. So thank you so much for coming on and telling us the stories, and keep on keeping on. That's all you can do, right? You're teaching the future. Aviva Alvarez-Zaxson, Ms. Z, World History Ethnic Studies teacher over at Hamilton High. Christy Collette, third grade teacher at Newcastle and Reseda. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all the time we have for GLA today. Tomorrow in this slot, another special radio episode of KCRW's podcast, Bodies. We're back on Monday with a new episode of GLA. Next week, we head to the Evergreen Cemetery in Boyle Heights for Dia de los Muertos, reintroduced to the Mexican-American community there back in the 1970s. You'll hear that story. Plus, it was nice to see the rain on Monday, wasn't it? That's going to do a lot to prevent wildfires in the near future. But with climate change and longer and drier spells, can you actually build an entirely fireproof home? Some folks are close. That's next week. I know the topic of climate change can leave you uneasy and stressed out. Yeah, same here. But there are people finding myriad ways to make a difference. Maybe you know someone who's doing things big or small to turn the tide. Maybe even you. Let us know at kcrw.com/GLA. We'd love to hear from you there. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ear tonight. Have a great night.